Thanks for tuning in to another installment of Advanced TV Herstory, a podcast that analyzes shows and celebrates women of television. Thousands of comedies, variety shows, and dramas have aired, yet the presence of strong women, both in front of and behind the camera, is often a story untold. Well, Advanced TV Herstory begs to differ. There's so much more, and it's worth telling and retelling. Sometimes shows offer great leadership lessons, or are so timeless in their writing that people say the series has aged well. We'll explore those shows further. We'll revisit moments in TV where women broke records, exceeded expectations, or put their careers on the line. Advanced TV Herstory will connect the treasures of the past to the great potential of today's TV and online platforms, and how it all plays a part in being a woman in America today. Tomorrow's success is rooted in understanding what has come before us. So gear up for a little storytelling and fun, sociology, fashion, economics, or strategy. It's all here in Advanced TV Herstory. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. Oh, the life lessons we, as women, learn from TV. And some days, the greatest challenge of this podcast is identifying the core component of a lesson and presenting it to you in a way that resonates. Lessons of diligence, courage, teamwork, and believing in yourself. This is the powerful stuff delivered in the most powerful medium in our country. It needs to be part of our shared experience as women of America.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurmond, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma.
This installment of Advanced TV Herstory examines the most basic elements of an event that changed the lives of American women. It captivated millions of viewers. It was talked about by millions more. It was the era before the internet, but came about courtesy of cable TV. I am speaking of Anita Hill and her testimony during the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings.
My purpose was to, as clearly as possible, tell the Senate about behavior that I had experienced at the hand of Clarence Thomas. I couldn't say, oh, well, I'm going to prove sexual harassment. I couldn't do that. I could say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell what happened to me.
Let's hope that the writers of Herstory include as many paragraphs as possible about the courage and message of Anita Hill when she took the stand to testify as a witness in Washington, D.C. In October 1991, Professor Hill appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee in opposition to the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the United States Supreme Court. It was televised on C-SPAN. She told her story of being a young lawyer in Washington in two government offices. Thomas was her boss. The obvious lesson, and in fact Professor Hill's legacy, is that sometimes that which is difficult is essential. Truth can be painful, even more so to relive or share on national TV, and to be scolded and intimidated by a group of powerful white men seated at a table, it was a spectacle. We'll review Hill's testimony, exchanges she had with both Democrat and Republican senators, and we'll hear a bit from Hill herself, two decades later, about why it was all worth it. So first, some background. In July 1991, President George H.W. Bush nominated Clarence Thomas, who is a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals, to succeed Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Marshall had been the first African-American on the High Court. Thomas would only be the second. A nominee is fully appointed through a majority vote of the United States Senate, which in 1991 was held by a Democratic majority. Prior to that vote, the Senate Judiciary Committee conducts a hearing while behind the scenes the FBI and other agencies vet the nominee. So for a candidate such as Thomas, his earlier appointment to the Court of Appeals, just 18 months earlier, should have made his vetting simpler. But this was a time, though, when Supreme Court nominations had hit a particularly contentious reception with the public and through the Senate. In 1987, Judge Robert Bork had been nominated to the High Court by President Reagan. C-SPAN And cable TV's 24-hour news cycle was hard at work, even in the late 80s, conducting its own vetting of Judge Bork in the court of public opinion. And when your resume, like Bork's, includes that you were instrumental in firing the Watergate special prosecutor who had requested President Nixon's tapes, you should know it's an uphill battle. Bork's nomination was defeated by an orchestrated onslaught of telephone calls, letters, and demonstrations. This is a glaring moment in history. Pay attention to this, because this really is, it's a turning point, and it's what we're living with today. This is a glaring moment in history that revealed the growing power of messaging and political strategists using selected media and connecting with constituencies to engage in the political process. Though, for many, the notion that a Supreme Court justice's nomination should not be political, this really takes you back to your political science class. So by the time President Bush placed Thomas's name into nomination in 1991, the political operatives and the media, they were in a race to find out who he really was. In the case of Judge Clarence Thomas, now President Bush, who had been vice president under Ronald Reagan, did not want this to turn into another Bork. The Bush operatives weren't going to play Mr. Nice Guy this time. And decades later, Hill reflects candidly on that point, something I'll get into in a bit. So as you'll hear from her statement later in this podcast, Professor Hill was contacted by, quote, a member of the Judiciary Committee and asked to provide a statement regarding her experience in working for Thomas nearly a decade earlier. 3 months after President Bush announced Thomas as his candidate for the court, the committee convened. The media had become aware of Professor Hill's statement, so it was with tremendous fanfare that C-SPAN aired the entire testimony that comprised Judge Thomas's hearing. So complain about cable TV all you want, but without C-SPAN, and that's the acronym for Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, C-SPAN. Transparency wouldn't be what it is today. In the early 1980s, the New York Times praised C-SPAN for its entry into areas that were once shielded from public view. Sometimes it's dry, but in 1991, all eyes were on C-SPAN coverage. Now, my disclaimer to you is this. Having watched the Anita Hill testimony in my late 20s, I found rewatching those hours of testimony to be incredibly painful. My respect for Professor Hill, her composure, and her morals has only grown in 25 years. My disdain for a table of men who are accorded power by the people to denigrate and intimidate a citizen who didn't invite this upon herself, my disdain has multiplied exponentially. So I confess I didn't review all the testimony of Hill or of Clarence Thomas. You'll be hard-pressed, however, to find a woman who remembers the testimony and the news who doesn't shiver a bit. One listener, a lawyer, who learned I was tackling this Anita Hill segment, sent me this note. And I quote, "In 1991, I was 21. I was raised in a strange paradox of republicanism and gender equality. I find those mutually exclusive today. And my dad was a conservative, but was raised by his older sisters after his father died when he was 9. He taught me to think for myself, which has led me to being a liberal. I think my dad was proud of that. I like to think he was. As a young woman, I started to question the conservative notion that Hill, quote, asked for it, and that she was lying for her own gain. What gain, I ask. As an older woman, I look back and wonder, is this where rape culture became abundantly obvious to anyone who chooses to look at it? It grieves me the way that Hill was minimized. The way Anita Hill is treated in the hearings is a tiny, tiny view into what every rape victim faces, and why so many choose to never say a word. Watching the testimony was like watching verbal rape." That's a very powerful message, and I am grateful that there are people who have taken that moment that Anita Hill brought to the American public, internalized it, and continue to catalyze it toward good and toward support for others and toward understanding the processes that go into creating a culture, whether that's a culture that endorses rape, accommodates rape, or in any way does anything to advance the violence that can be found against women. So, on that cheery note, find excellent montages and entire testimony of Hill and Thomas on YouTube. It is hard to watch, but if you've never listened to it before, it's essential. Turn it on while you're cleaning your oven or your refrigerator or doing your ironing or your laundry. You will never have a better shine or better looking clothes, I swear. Okay, C-SPAN gave it to us real time. But Hill herself says that enough time has passed that this story needs to be retold. So here it is, with an attendant amount of sugar to make the medicine go down. First, the story is best told by Hill herself in her statement, which was ranked as number 69 in American Rhetoric's top 100 speeches of the 20th century. At least that's what Wikipedia says.
Welcome. We're happy that you are here, and let us stand and be sworn, if you will. Professor, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
Thank you. Professor Hill, please make whatever statement you would wish to make to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, friend. I instruct the officers, do not let anyone in or out of that door while Professor Hill is making her statement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma. I was born on a farm in Okmulgee County, Oklahoma, in 1956. I am the youngest of 13 children. I had my early education in Okmulgee County. My father, Albert Hill, is a farmer in that area. My mother's name is Irma Hill. She is also a farmer and a housewife. My childhood was one of a lot of hard work and not much money, but it was one of solid family affection as represented by my parents. I was reared in a religious atmosphere in the Baptist faith, and I have been a member of the Antioch Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, since 1983. It is a very warm part of my life at the present time. For my undergraduate work, I went to Oklahoma State University and graduated from there in 1977. I am attaching to this statement a copy of my resume for further details of my education. I graduated from the university with academic honors and proceeded to the Yale Law School, where I received my JD degree in 1980. Upon graduation from law school, I became a practicing lawyer with the Washington, D.C. firm of Wald, Hargrader, and Ross. In 1981, I was introduced to now Judge Thomas by a mutual friend. Judge Thomas told me that he was anticipating a political appointment, and he asked if I would be interested in working with him. He was, in fact, appointed as Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. After he had taken that post, he asked if I would become his assistant, and I accepted that position. In my early period there, I had two major projects. The first was an article I wrote for Judge Thomas's signature on the education of minority students. The second was the organization of a seminar on high-risk students, which was abandoned because Judge Thomas transferred to the EEOC, where he became the chairman of that office. During this period at the Department of Education, my working relationship with Judge Thomas was positive. I had a good deal of responsibility and independence. I thought he respected my work and that he trusted my judgment. After approximately 3 months of working there, he asked me to go out socially with him. What happened next and telling the world about it are the two most difficult things, experiences of my life. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration and great number of sleepless nights that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone but my close friends. I declined the invitation to go out socially with him and explained to him that I thought it would jeopardize at the time I considered to be a very good working relationship. I had a normal social life with other men outside of the office. I believed then, as now, that having a social relationship with a person who was supervising my work would be ill-advised. I was very uncomfortable with the idea and told him so.
What's not to believe about this woman's credibility? Following her statement, her family was ushered into the hearing room. If you would watch it, you'd see that she's wearing a conservative teal jacket and likely a matching or black skirt. Professor Hill gained confidence in her cadence, but there are moments when you can hear her pause and her voice quivered. And I so wish that I could give her a hug. You feel for her. And you know that her upbringing didn't prepare her to discuss pornography and oral sex or any man's endowment or a man's prowess or sex with animals with anyone, let alone her boss, or a table of powerful white men that was being broadcast across the world. Back to Hill.
I thought that by saying no and explaining my reasons, my employer would abandon his social suggestions. However, to my regret, in the following few weeks, he continued to ask me out on several occasions. He pressed me to justify my reasons for saying no to him. These incidents took place in his office or mine. They were in the form of private conversations, which would not have been overheard by anyone else. My working relationship became even more strained when Judge Thomas began to use work situations to discuss sex. On these occasions, he would call me into his office for reports on education issues and projects, or he might suggest that because of the time pressures of his schedule, we go to lunch to a government cafeteria. After a brief discussion of work, he would turn the conversation to a discussion of sexual matters. His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. Because I was extremely uncomfortable talking about sex with him at all, and particularly in such a graphic way, I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects. I would also try to change the subject to education matters or to non-sexual personal matters, such as his background or his beliefs. My efforts to change the subject were rarely successful. Throughout the period of these conversations, he also from time to time asked me for social engagements. My reaction to these conversations was to avoid them by eliminating opportunities for us to engage in extended conversations. This was difficult because at the time I was his only assistant at the Office of Education, or Office for Civil Rights. During the latter part of my time at the Department of Education, the social pressures and any conversation of his offensive behavior ended. I began both to believe and hope that our working relationship could be a proper, cordial, and professional one. When Judge Thomas was made chair of the EEOC, I needed to face the question of whether to go with him. I was asked to do so, and I did. The work itself was interesting, and at that time it appeared that the sexual overtures which had so troubled me had ended. I also faced the realistic fact that I had no alternative job. While I might have gone back to private practice, perhaps in my old firm or at another, I was dedicated to civil rights work, and my first choice was to be in that field. Moreover, at that time, the Department of Education itself was a dubious venture. President Reagan was seeking to abolish the entire department. For my first months at the EEOC, where I continued to be an assistant to Judge Thomas, there were no sexual conversations or overtures. However, during the fall and winter of 1982, these began again. The comments were random, ranged from pressing me about why I didn't go out with him to remarks about my personal appearance. I remember his saying that someday I would have to tell him the real reason that I wouldn't go out with him.
Remember everything your mother told you about protecting your reputation? In itself, for an African-American woman of working-class parents to attend college and law school and hold a position as a law professor in 1991, this was a big deal. She was a role model for women of all colors. She had chosen government work, toiling in policy to create level playing fields for children, for teachers, and later government employees. This wasn't reality TV. This was one woman retelling some of her most unpleasant moments of her early career on a field that was anything but level.
He began to show displeasure in his tone and voice and his demeanor and his continued pressure for an explanation. He commented on what I was wearing in terms of whether it made me more or less sexually attractive. The incidents occurred in his inner office at the EEOC. One of the oddest episodes I remember was an occasion in which Thomas was drinking a Coke in his office. He got up from the table at which we were working, went over to his desk to get the Coke, looked at the can and asked, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?" On other occasions, he referred to the size of his own penis as being larger than normal, and he also spoke on some occasions of the pleasures he had given to women with oral sex. At this point, late 1982, I began to feel severe stress on the job. I began to be concerned that Clarence Thomas might take out his anger with me by degrading me or not giving me important assignments. I also thought that he might find an excuse for dismissing me. In January of 1983, I began looking for another job. I was handicapped because I feared that if he found out, he might make it difficult for me to find other employment, and I might be dismissed from the job I had. Another factor that made my search more difficult was that there was a period, this was during a period of a hiring freeze in the government. In February 1983, I was hospitalized for 5 days on an emergency basis for acute stomach pain, which I attributed to stress on the job. Once out of the hospital, I became more committed to find other employment and sought further to minimize my contact with Thomas. This became easier when Allison Duncan became office director, because most of my work was then funneled through her, and I had contact with Clarence Thomas mostly in staff meetings. In the spring of 1983, an opportunity to teach at Oral Roberts University opened up. I participated in a seminar, taught an afternoon session in a seminar at Oral Roberts University. The dean of the university saw me teaching and inquired as to whether I would be interested in pursuing a career in teaching, beginning at Oral Roberts University. I agreed to take the job in large part because of my desire to escape the pressures I felt at the EEOC due to Judge Thomas. When I informed him that I was leaving in July, I recall that his response was that now I would no longer have an excuse for not going out with him. I told him that I still preferred not to do so. At some time after that meeting, he asked if he could take B to dinner at the end of the term. When I declined, he assured me that the dinner was a professional courtesy only and not a social invitation. I reluctantly agreed to accept that invitation, but only if it was at the very end of a working day. On, as I recall, the last day of my employment at the EEOC in the summer of 1983, I did have dinner with Clarence Thomas. We went directly from work to a restaurant near the office. We talked about the work I had done, both at education and at the EEOC. He told me that he was pleased with all of it, except for an article and speech that I had done for him while we were at the Office for Civil Rights. Finally, he made a comment that I will vividly remember. He said that if I ever told anyone of his behavior, that it would ruin his career. This was not an apology, nor was it an explanation. That was his last remark about the possibility of our going out or reference to his behavior.
Professor Hill had dotted every I and crossed every T. She had answered in detail the subsequent contact she had with Judge Thomas. Sure, she had relegated the past to the past, but the contacts she had with him were professional in nature. Senators had no clue of the continued value she had to place on her professional affiliation with him. What? No woman scorned? No emotional outburst? That can't be possible. The lesson here, listeners, is this. Anita Hill did not have the luxury not to fear the consequences. Not as a woman in the 1980s. Not as a woman of color. And certainly not in relation to a sexual harassment claim.
In July of 1983, I left Washington, D.C. area and have had minimal contacts with Judge Clarence Thomas since. I am, of course, aware from the press that some questions have been raised about conversations I had with Judge Clarence Thomas after I left the EEOC. From 1983 until today, I have seen Judge Thomas only twice. On one occasion, I needed to get a reference from him, and on another, he made a public appearance in Tulsa. On one occasion, he called me at home, and we had an inconsequential conversation. On one occasion, he called me without reaching me, and I returned the call without reaching him, and nothing came of it. I have, on at least three occasions, been asked to ask as a conduit to him for others. I knew his secretary, Diane Holt. We had worked together at both EEOC and education. There were occasions in which I spoke to her, and on some of these occasions, undoubtedly, I passed on some casual comment to then-Chairman Thomas. There were a series of calls in the first 3 months of 1985, occasioned by a group in Tulsa, which wished to have a civil rights conference. They wanted Judge Thomas to be the speaker and enlisted my assistance for this purpose. I did call in January and February to no effect, and finally suggested to the person directly involved that she put the matter into her own hands and call directly. She did so in March of 1985. In connection with that March invitation, Ms. Cahal wanted conference materials for the seminar, and some research was needed. I was asked to try to get the information and did attempt to do so. There was another call about another possible conference in the July of 1985. In August of 1987, I was in Washington, D.C., and I did call Diane Holt. In the course of this conversation, she asked me how long I was going to be in town, and I told her. It is recorded in the message as August 15th. It was, in fact, August 20th. She told me about Judge Thomas's marriage, and I did say, congratulate him. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone except my closest friends. As I've said before, these last few days have been very trying and very hard for me. And it hasn't just been the last few days this week. It has actually been over a month now that I have been under the strain of this issue. Telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life, but it is very close to having to live through the experience that occasioned this meeting. I may have used poor judgment early on in my relationship with this issue. I was aware, however, that telling at any point in my career could adversely affect my future career. And I did not want, early on, to burn all the bridges to the EEOC. As I said, I may have used poor judgment. Perhaps I should have taken angry or even militant steps, both when I was in the agency or after I left it. But I must confess to the world that the course that I took seemed the better as well as the easier approach. I declined any comment to newspapers, but later when Senate staff asked me about these matters, I felt I had a duty to report. I have no personal vendetta against Clarence Thomas. I seek only to provide the committee with information which it may regard as relevant. It would have been more comfortable to remain silent. It took no initiative to inform anyone. I took no initiative to inform anyone. But when I was asked by a representative of this committee to report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth. I could not keep silent. In July of 1983, I left Washington, D.C. area and have had minimal contacts with Judge Clarence Thomas since. I am, of course, aware from the press that some questions have been raised about conversations I had with Judge Clarence Thomas after I left the EEOC. From 1983 until today, I have seen Judge Thomas only twice. On one occasion, I needed to get a reference from him, and on another, he made a public appearance in Tulsa. On one occasion, he called me at home, and we had an inconsequential conversation. On one occasion, he called me without reaching me, and I returned the call without reaching him, and nothing came of it. I have, on at least three occasions, been asked to ask as a conduit to him for others. I knew his secretary, Diane Holt. We had worked together at both EEOC and education. There were occasions in which I spoke to her, and on some of these occasions, undoubtedly, I passed on some casual comment to then-Chairman Thomas. There were a series of calls in the first 3 months of 1985 occasioned by a group in Tulsa which wished to have a civil rights conference. They wanted Judge Thomas to be the speaker and enlisted my assistance for this purpose. I did call in January and February to no effect and finally suggested to the person directly involved that she put the matter into her own hands and call directly. She did. So in March of 1985. In connection with that March invitation, Ms. Cajal wanted conference materials for the seminar, and some research was needed. I was asked to try to get the information and did attempt to do so. There was another call about another possible conference in the July of 1985. In August of 1987, I was in Washington, D.C., and I did call Diane Holt. In the course of this conversation, she asked me how long I was going to be in town, and I told her. It is recorded in the message as August 15th. It was, in fact, August 20th. She told me about Judge Thomas's marriage, and I did say, congratulate him. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone except my closest friends. As I've said before, these last few days have been very trying and very hard for me. And it hasn't just been the last few days this week. It has actually been over a month now that I have been under the strain of this issue. Telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life, but it is very close to having to live through the experience that occasioned this meeting. I may have used poor judgment early on in my relationship with this issue. I was aware, however, that telling at any point in my career could adversely affect my future career. And I did not want, early on, to burn all the bridges to the EEOC. As I said, I may have used poor judgment. Perhaps I should have taken angry or even militant steps, both when I was in the agency or after I left it. But I must confess to the world that the course that I took seemed the better as well as the easier approach. I declined any comment to newspapers, but later when Senate staff asked me about these matters, I felt I had a duty to report. I have no personal vendetta against Clarence Thomas. I seek only to provide the committee with information which it may regard as relevant. It would have been more comfortable to remain silent. It took no initiative to inform anyone. I took no initiative to inform anyone. But when I was asked by a representative of this committee to report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth. I could not keep silent.
So there you have it. No motivation to take this to any public level until she was asked to do so, in light of Thomas's nomination to the highest court in the United States. Hill is an officer of the court and a professor to aspiring lawyers. Had she declined to come forward, sexism and sexual harassment would have prevailed. We can only admire her for her courage, as well as her impeccable resume and delivery as the proverbial well-placed pump that kept the door ajar just long enough for America to sit up, take notice, and change. Okay, now for the harder part. Yes, it gets harder. And to have lived it, it's why no one talks about it. It's that painful. Some of the inquiry was conducted by members of the United States Senate. All men. Of course, all men. Professor Hill gave every woman in America the playbook of how to manage an untenable situation when it was happening and how to recount it years later. Her appearance and testimony literally changed lives, as she recounted in 2014 in an interview with CBS This Morning.
In so many ways, because of the attention it brought, because of the thousands of letters that I have from people around talking about what the experience has meant to them in their workplaces. In 1991, or since 1991, we've come to terms with the fact that, yes, sexual harassment is wrong, and it does matter, and it exists, it's prevalent. But we still haven't figured out exactly what to do about it. And so, in addition to my career as a professor, and as an educator, and as a lawyer, I've been able to go out and try to help people understand how we can move forward and what we do need to do about it.
To listen to the hearing is to understand that middle-aged and old white men in power have no way to understand Anita Hill's experience. Most were lawyers. Some were assigned the task of destroying her credibility. This goes back to that lesson about Robert Bork. They were used to questioning witnesses or government officials until they got answers, and that those answers proved that they were the smartest ones in the room. At the table, the only thing that separated the male perspective of Republican from Democrat was the aggressiveness with which they pursued Professor Hill. Vice President Joe Biden, who chaired the committee as the senator from Delaware, was at times very gracious, but also a bit gratuitous, such as when he asked her to recite, quote, for the record, Thomas's graphic comments to her, or when he made a big deal about having her introduce her family. It was all just gratuitous, and now you have a working definition of the word gratuitous.
Tell the committee, what was the most embarrassing of all the incidences that you have alleged?
I think the one that was the most embarrassing was his discussion of pornography involving these women with large breasts and engaged in variety of sex with different people or animals. That was the thing that embarrassed me the most and made me feel the most humiliated.
If you can, in his words, not yours, in his words, can you tell us what on that occasion he said to you? You have described the essence of the conversation. In order for us to determine, well, can you tell us in his words what he said?
I really cannot quote him verbatim. I can remember something like, you really ought to see these films that I've seen, or this material that I've seen. This woman has this kind of breast, breasts that measure this size, and they've got her in there with all kinds of things. She's doing all kinds of different sex acts, and, you know, that kind of, those were the kinds of words where he expressed his enjoyment of it and seemed to try to encourage me to enjoy that kind of material as well.
Did he indicate?
Next came the Republican senator from Pennsylvania. Arlen Specter was a Republican in the Senate until 2009, when the party showed him the door and he became a Democrat. He was also a former district attorney in Philadelphia, and most would say that with regard to the Anita Hill testimony, he was the very worst. I give Professor Hill all the credit in the world for making it through each of Specter's turns at the microphone without throwing up, walking out, or screaming.
You said that you were concerned that Judge Thomas might take it out on me by downgrading me or by not giving me important assignments. I also thought that he might find an excuse for dismissing me. As an experienced attorney and as someone who was in the field of handling sexual harassment cases, didn't it cross your mind that if you needed to defend yourself from what you anticipated he might do, that your evidentiary position would be much stronger if you had made some notes?
No, it did not.
Well, why not?
I don't know why it didn't cross my mind.
Well, the law of evidence is that notes are very important. You're nodding yes. Is present recollection refreshed, right?
Yes, indeed.
Prior recollection recorded, right?
Yes.
In a controversy, if Judge Thomas took some action against you, mm-hmm. and you had to defend yourself on the ground that he was being malicious in retaliation for your turning him down, wouldn't those notes be very influential, if not determinative, in enabling you to establish your legal position?
I think they would be very influential, yes.
So given your experience, if all this happened, since all this happened, why not make the notes?
Well, it might have been a good choice to make the notes. I did not do it, though. Maybe I made the wrong choice in not making the notes. I'm not a person, I was not interested in any litigation. I was not interested. If I had been dismissed, very likely I would have just gone out and tried to find another job. I was not interested in filing a claim against him, and perhaps that's why it did not occur to me to make notes about it.
Well, I'm not on the point of your being interested in making a claim. What I am on the point of is your statement that you were concerned that he might take retaliatory action against you, and therefore the inference arises that the notes would have been something which would have been done by an experienced lawyer.
One of the things that I did do at that time was to document my work. I went through very meticulously with every assignment that I was given. This was this really was in response to the concerns that I had about being fired. I went through, I logged in every work assignment that I received. the date that it was received, the action that was requested, the action that I took on it, the date that it went out. So that I did do that in order to protect myself. But well, I did not write down any of the comments or conversations.
Well, when you comment about documenting your work to protect yourself because of concern of being fired, wouldn't the same precise thought about documentation have led you to document Judge Thomas's statements to you?
Well, I was documenting my work so that I could show to a new employer that I had, in fact, done these things.
Spector asked numerous questions, often rambling. His statements leading up to sort of questions were in reference to documents that were not fully vetted themselves. His wandering remarks that led up to some sort of question often required Hill's close attention, and she tracked. And without fail, she'd let him prattle on for a few minutes, and then, with a straight face and earnest voice, she would ask, "Could you be more clear? I don't understand what you're asking." So Hill returned each volley with precision. Point Hill. In this clip, Spector attempts to undermine her credibility through a statement provided by the dean of Oral Roberts University Law School, in other words, a white man at a conservative private institution that Hill worked at for a short period of time.
Ask you about one statement of Charles Coffey, Dean Coffey, because he knew you and Judge Thomas very well. I want to ask you for your comment on it. There's a similar reference in the Doggett statement, which I'm not going to ask you about because you haven't read the Doggett statement, and you say you do not remember him, and out of fairness, I want to give you a chance to read that first, but you do know Dean Coffey, and he does know Judge Thomas, and this is his concluding statement, quote, "I find the references to the alleged sexual harassment not only unbelievable, but preposterous. I'm convinced that such are the product of fantasy." Close quote. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I would only say that I'm not given to fantasy. This is not something that I would have come forward with if I were not absolutely sure about what it is I am saying. I weighed this very carefully, I considered it carefully, and I made a determination to come forward. I think it's unfortunate that that comment was made by a man who purports to be someone who says he knows me. And I think it's just inaccurate.
Well, you have added during the course of your testimony today two new witnesses whom you made this complaint to. When you talked to the FBI, there was one witness. And you're testifying today that you're now, quote, recalling more, that you had repressed a lot. And the question which I have for you is, how reliable is your testimony in October of 1991 on events that occurred 8-10 years ago when you are adding new factors, explaining them by saying you have repressed a lot, and in the context of a sexual harassment charge where the federal law is very firm on a 6-month period of limitation, how sure can you expect this committee to be on the accuracy of your statements?
Well, I think if you start to look at each individual problem with the statement, then you're not going to be satisfied that it's true. But I think the statement has to be taken as a whole. There is nothing in the statement nothing in my statement, there is no motivation that would show that I would make up something like this. And I guess one really does have to understand something about the nature of sexual harassment. It is very difficult for people to come forward with these things, these kinds of things. And it wasn't as though I rushed forward with this information. I can only tell you what happened to the best of my recollection, what occurred, and ask you to take that into account. Now, you have to make your own judgment about it from there on, but I do want you to take into account the whole thing.
This is the fuzzy but painful memory most American women who lived through these long weeks of herstory remember about the hearings. But amazingly, back to that 2014 CBS This Morning interview that I've been playing clips of, that was conducted by Gail King and Charlie Rose. Seriously, Charlie Rose has the gall to ask perhaps the most inane question of the year.
I absolutely understood that they were going to ask questions, but the level of outside incidents of press conferences and statements about me that were made by people who were on the committee, I think were so far beyond what I expected to happen. I expected to be able to give my testimony, for them to ask probing questions, because I really wanted people to understand exactly what had happened. But I didn't think that all of the outside campaigning that was done against my testimony by the people who were supposed to be determining what the truth was appropriate.
But now when you look back, having just said that, do you think the hearings were fair when you look back at it today?
No. No, I don't. I don't think they were fair because, again, the people who were the finders of fact, the triers of truth, were outside campaigning against me.
Yeah.
And so you cannot have a fair hearing. It would be like having a judge on a judicial panel outside giving press conferences about one of the witnesses. You can't have a fair hearing.
But the question from those senators was unfair?
The questions themselves were not fair. They were ill-informed questions. They were drawing on myths and things that had not been proven, that no one had sworn to, the statements that I don't even know that they were even accurate statements. Senator Simpson said that he had letters and faxes, but when asked to present them, he refused to present them. So I don't even know if those things were in fact true.
You know, Anita, I was in college at the time.
This installment of Advanced TV Herstory gives you just enough knowledge about Anita Hill to defend her honor in a hostile conversation. But if you want more, and you want to learn more, and you want to become much more knowledgeable, find the hours of material on YouTube. Or read Hill's works about the hearings, sexual harassment, and gender issues. That would come in her 1995 book entitled Race, Gender, and Power in America, The Legacy of the Hill-Thomas Hearings, which she co-edited with Emma Coleman Jordan. It's a great resource. Through the years, Hill has continued the work she loves and continued to be a voice for professional women facing steep odds. Her autobiography, Speaking Truth to Power, came out in 1997 and documents the Clarence Thomas matter as well as her interest in civil and human rights. She's among the many who contributed to the 2003 book Sisterhood is Forever, the Women's Anthology for a New Millennium, and that's edited by Robin Morgan. Hill's third book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home, came out in 2011. Hill is currently the University Professor of Social Policy, Law, and Women's and Gender Studies at Brandeis University. To be a university professor is one of Brandeis's most prestigious academic honors. The university describes the position as being held by a faculty member of surpassing eminence, whose work cuts across boundaries. Not far from Boston, Brandeis University is a very cool institution, founded by the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt and was named after Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish member of the High Court. And maybe it's no irony that the Brandeis motto, translated into English, is, quote, truth even unto its innermost parts. Truth even unto its most innermost parts. I'm guessing they weren't thinking those parts would include genitalia. Hill is quoted as saying, quote, I resent the idea that people would blame the messenger for the message rather than looking at the content of the message itself. End quote. Through the power of television, the message indeed sunk into the very fabric of our American experience. It fundamentally changed us. And so today, sexuality, rape culture, our understanding of victims' rights and evidence, and even the existence of a show like Law and Order SVU, where would we be without Anita Hill and her courage?
Civil rights law that was passed in 1991, for the first time, women, when they proved their claims, were able to fully recover. That
damages.
Was fully recover the damages, the losses that they had suffered. Mm-hmm. That was monumental. But, you know, as important as the women running for Congress and the greater attention that we had with women going forward and mm-hmm. filing complaints, were the public conversations and the private conversations mm-hmm. that people had with their own family members, stories that they had never shared before, and our ability to talk about the issue as a society has moved because of those conversations.
They say because of you. People say because of you, Anita Hill, that girls today know that sexual harassment is not okay and that they can do something about it.
Thanks for listening to this important segment. There's a lot to absorb. Audio has been pulled from the CBS This Morning interview of 2014, conducted by Gail King and Charlie Rose. It's available on YouTube. This was a topic too emotional and too powerful to just let it fly from my keyboard to my microphone, so I am grateful to good friend Petra, high-powered attorney with memory of steel, who endures marathon document editing without breaking a sweat, and has a feminist heart of gold, for her work in smoothing out my transitions, cleaning up my commas, and making sure that my writing was succinct on this very important issue. Friendly listeners, it's you, or Petra, or any of my other past collaborators, and the so many others who own a piece of advanced TV herstory. If you don't already, please subscribe to Advanced TV Herstory, this podcast, on iTunes, or at our hosting site, Libsyn, Libsyn. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @TVHerstory. This script and past scripts are found at my website, CynthiaBemisAbrams.com, and that's, too, a place where you can leave comments or make inquiry for a presentation. Share your thoughts about this installment or ideas for others by shooting an email to advancedtvherstory@gmail.com. That's all one word. And if the Anita Hill hearings were a special part of your experience and your memory, please send that along. If there's significant storytelling going on, I would love to be able to share that back then as a testimony to the impact that this podcast is having on listeners. But for now, you're a peach for listening, and I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. Stay in touch.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee. My name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma.